Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, by Simon Sebag Montefiore. Read by John Nettles. At around 7 p.m. on the 8th of November 1932, Nadia Aleluyeva Stalin, aged 31, the oval-faced and brown-eyed wife of the Bolshevik General Secretary, was dressing for the raucous annual party to celebrate the anniversary of the revolution. Puritanical, earnest but fragile, Nadia prided herself on her Bolshevik modesty, wearing the dullest dresses and no makeup. But tonight she was making a special effort. In the Stalin's gloomy apartment, she twirled for her sister, Anna, in a long, unusually fashionable black dress, with red roses embroidered around it, a present from Berlin. She had indulged in a stylish hairdo instead of her usual severe bun. She playfully placed a scarlet tea rose in her black hair. A few hundred yards to the east, closer to Lenin's mausoleum and Red Square, Joseph Stalin, the General Secretary of the Bolshevik Party and Vosht, leader of the Soviet Union, was in his office, the little corner, at an angle of the triangular Yellow Palace. Stalin, now 53, 22 years Nadia's senior and the father of her two children, was meeting his favoured secret policeman. Genrikh Yagoda, deputy chairman of the GPU, informed Stalin of new plots against him in the party, and more turbulence in the countryside. Stalin, assisted by Premier Molotov, 42, and his economics chief Valerian Kubishev, 45, who looked like a mad poet, ordered the arrest of those who opposed them. Stalin feared losing the Ukraine itself, which, in parts, had descended into a dystopia of starvation and disorder. When Yagoda left, the others stayed, talking about their war to break the back of the peasantry, whatever the cost to the millions starving in history's greatest man-made famine. They were determined to use grain to finance their gargantuan push to make Russia a modern industrial power. But that night, tragedy would be closer to home. Stalin was to face a personal crisis that was the most wounding and mysterious of his career. At 8 p.m., Stalin, a small, sturdy figure who walked ponderously yet briskly with a rough, pigeon-toed gait, ambled down the steps towards the party, through the snowy alleyways and squares of the Kremlin, dressed in his party tunic, baggy old trousers, soft leather boots, old army greatcoat, and his wolf shapka with earmuffs. His left arm was slightly shorter than the other, but much less noticeable than it became in old age, and he was usually smoking a cigarette or puffing on his pipe. His head and thick, low hair, still black but with specks of the first grey, radiated the graceful strength of the mountain men of the Caucasus. His almost oriental, feline eyes were honey-coloured, but flashed a lupine yellow in anger. As female admirers recall, Stalin was still attractive to women with whom he flirted shyly and clumsily. He was already famous for his Sphinxian inscrutability and phlegmatic modesty, represented by the pipe he ostentatiously puffed like a peasant elder. Beneath the eerie calm of these unfathomable waters were deadly whirlpools of ambition, anger, and unhappiness. Capable both of moving with controlled gradualism and of reckless gambols, he seemed enclosed inside a suit of steely armor, but his antennae were intensely sensitive. His fiery Georgian temper was so uncontrollable that he'd almost ruined his career by unleashing it against Lenin's wife. He was a mercurial neurotic, with the tense, seething temperament of a highly strung actor who revels in his own drama. Lazar Kaganovich, one of his closest comrades for over 30 years, recalled him as a different man at different times. I knew no less than 5 or 6 Stalins. However, the opening of Stalin's archives and many newly available sources illuminate him more than ever before, a super-intelligent and gifted politician, for whom his own historic role was paramount, a nervy intellectual who manically read history and literature, a fidgety hypochondriac suffering from chronic tonsillitis, psoriasis, rheumatic aches from his deformed arm, and the iciness of his Siberian exile. Garrulous, sociable, and a fine singer, this lonely and unhappy man ruined every love relationship and friendship in his life by sacrificing happiness to political necessity and cannibalistic paranoia. This atheist owed everything to priests, and saw the world in terms of sin and repentance. Yet he was a convinced Marxist fanatic from his youth. His fanaticism was semi-Islamic, his messianic egotism boundless. He assumed the imperial mission of the Russians, yet remained very much a Georgian, bringing the vendettas of his forefathers northwards to Muscovy. Most public men share the Caesarian habit of detaching themselves to admire their own figures on the world stage, but Stalin's detachment was a degree greater. His adopted son, Artyom Sergeyev, remembers Stalin shouting at his son Vasily for exploiting his father's name. "But I'm a Stalin too," said Vasily. "No, you're not," replied Stalin. "You're not Stalin, and I'm not Stalin. Stalin is Soviet power. Stalin is what he is in the newspapers and the portraits. Not you, no, not even me." He was a self-creation. A man who invents his name, birthday, nationality, education, and his entire past in order to change history and play the role of leader is likely to end up in a mental institution unless he embraces by will, luck, and skill the movement and the moment that can overturn the natural order of things. Stalin was such a man. The movement was the Bolshevik Party. His moment, the decay of the Russian monarchy. After Stalin's death, it was fashionable to regard him as an aberration, but this was to rewrite history as crudely as Stalin did himself. Stalin's success was not an accident. No one alive was more suited to the conspiratorial intrigues, theoretical rooms, murderous dogmatism, and inhuman sternness of Lenin's party. It's hard to find a better synthesis between a man and a movement than the ideal marriage between Stalin and Bolshevism. He was a mirror of its virtues and faults.